Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Director of the Holocaust drama The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer, has described his film as two films, the one you see and the one you hear. My guest this week, Johnny Byrne, is the brilliant sound designer on the film. Byrne has worked with Glazer on movies and music videos for decades, but embarking on this project was frightening and working on it incredibly difficult, including on a personal level. But what they achieved is one of the best and most powerful films of the year. In The Zone of Interest, we follow Commandant Rudolf Huss and his wife Hedwig, played by Christian Friedel and Sandra Hüller, their children and their beautiful home and garden, with just a wall separating them from the extermination camp. It's The Normality of Evil, a film that speaks as much to the past as to the present. I just want to say that in the first part of our conversation about creating the soundscape from Zone of Interest, the talk includes some very difficult and emotional things to hear. This is not the only movie Johnny Byrne has this Oscar season. He's also worked on the critically acclaimed and award-winning Poor Things, starring Emma Stone, together with another longtime collaborator, director Yorgos Lanthimos. We also talk about creating alien sounds for Jordan Peele's Nope. What's his relationship to sound when he's not working, when he's just walking around as a civilian? What sounds he hates? And what Madonna taught him? We get into all that and more. Here is my fascinating conversation with Johnny Byrne. Mr. Byrne, thank you so much for joining me.
Christina, lovely to meet you. Thank you for your time.
We're going to get into several of your films and work, but I want to start with your incredible work with Jonathan Glazer in Zone of Interest. Now, you have worked together with him for decades. When he approached you with the Zone of Interest, what was your first reaction?
Yeah, I have worked for decades on many projects, outside of films as well, like, pop promos and commercials, things like that. But so we discussed the Zone of Interest in the years following Under the Skin. And John does gestate for some time, but I read the script probably first, maybe a year before filming. And my reaction was sort of somewhere near panic, probably. It was, oh my goodness, this film, you know, requires such responsibility in two ways. You know, like the film really needs an enormous amount of work from sound in order to make the whole thing work, and the responsibility and the immersion in the subject matter and of getting that right without sensationalizing. So my initial reaction was something pretty close to, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And then, you know, obviously, figuring out how to do it and reacting by spending a year researching everything that I could.
What was it he said to you? I'm sure it wasn't just one conversation, but that made you feel that we could make this important movie in the right way.
We knew that sound was going to be important, and that it was going to convey, you know, John was very clear that we would never go inside the camp, and that we all know, you know, we all have images in our head of the atrocities, and there's absolutely no interest from John, you know, or myself or anyone else to be displaying any of that. So I think that, you know, the challenge of drawing pictures in people's heads is really, you know, obviously why I was interested on a kind of, I suppose, selfish professional level, but more importantly, you know, telling the story, making sure this is not forgotten.
You've said that there's basically two films here, the one you hear and the one you see. Talk about what the film is that we hear.
Yeah, so the film we hear is this constant juxtaposition of, we have the The film one is the film you see, and that's the mundanity of the Hoss's family life with an enormous amount of detail to deliver an immersion of credibility. And the film that you hear is a soundscape of horror, and it's, you know, the most violent film I've ever worked on, and it's the death of many hundreds of thousands of people, and it is the result of you know, a year of research and a year of creation of sounds as best as possibly made to recreate those actions and those events, and then carefully placed on the film in order to, as unsensationally as possible, tell the story without going to the point of having to show any of this.
You talk about the research. What kind of research was it? And what did you learn from it in terms of the auditory soundscape that you were making?
Yeah, I mean, originally I just thought, wow, we need to know everything about what happened here and what that would have sounded like and how it would have sounded. And so from a sort of practical point of view, the physicality of, you know, like I had a map and I knew that that block had a lot of German guards in it, but this one was French prisoners and these ones were Polish. And so where those different voices would come from in the soundscape of a theater, and that, you know, the execution block where the volleys of six gunshots would regularly ring out, murdering 80 people a day, that came from 150 yards away. And that we would have to record that, you know, at that correct distance with the correct reflections of other buildings in to sound appropriate, and that we would need to know when it would be the right time to use those sounds. And also things like, you know, understanding that the guns that they used were the ones from the First World War, because, you know, the modern war machines would go to the front line. And so all the vehicles and all the things like that were all actually very old, but getting those specifically correct so that whenever we hear cars passing on the road, you know, it was the right stuff. But the bulk of it, and the certainly the more onerous task, was reading witness testimony and having access to the archives at Auschwitz Museum, and just reading and reading and reading for months, and my team and you know, my father and my brother helped me, you know, just reading everything we could and collating data, so that any time an event was described that might have an acoustic signature to it, I would document that, and I created a large document that was a series of events that we would then use our recordings to, as best as we could, recreate or reenact these scenarios. And, you know, and there were other sources, like, you know, John would, you know, whenever he found anything, he would send it to me, and it might, you know, there were many drawings that survivors made, and, you know, a picture telling 1,000 words would describe a scene, then we would, you know, make the sound of that. And so basically it was researching to create a document, and a document gave us a library, and the library was of hundreds and hundreds of different events that we understood had happened. And other things, like, you know, the sound of literally the electric fence, and that there were armament manufacturing and textile manufacturing, and the sound of the crematoria, of course, and the sound of you know, 100 people wearing wooden clogs marching across a gravelly surface, and all of those things that we needed to have in our disposal, because the process of making the film was that we created film one, we kind of finished it, and that was a nice family drama. And we didn't put any of film two onto that until we had that one pretty much locked down. So I had, through research, and, you know, I had the whole of the shoot and the first year of post-production to get all this other soundscape ready, so that when John felt it was the right time, you know, we could then start introducing that.
You talked about that you were reading some events. Is there any particular event you can tell me about that you read that really struck you in terms of thinking of its sound?
Yeah, I mean, people would choose to run at the electric fence rather than continue with what they were doing. And some of those things were so awful that, you know, we'd put them in and then took them out because something that didn't make it in, because it was just too blood-curdling and came across as sensationalized. You know, and that people were regularly whipped, you know, for no reason at all. And that there were guards would murder people on the spot for insolence or for or for seemingly fun or whatever. But so that that was the hard bit. Even talking about it now is pretty awful, but
I can
immerse in that for a period of time is tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I had a honestly a very physical reaction after seeing the movie this summer. It took me quite a while afterwards, left the theater and sat down. And what was that like for you? Just hearing you speak of it, I can see and hear that it's very impactful.
Yeah, certainly my wife said that, early on, she was like, I think you're getting depressed. And certainly the process of making any film is always an immersion. But this more so than any other, and an enormous, and we worked really hard right up until the Cannes premiere. And, those last months were very long. And weirdly, I woke up the morning after the Cannes premiere and had a terrible headache and a rash all over my legs. And I got viral meningitis and I was in hospital like a week. And the doctor explained to me something to do with, having a lot of cortisol and then that stops, and that's what's kept the bug anyway. But so I think
you literally had a physical reaction to
I actually emotion. Yeah, I actually did. So but the story needs telling, and it's not like I was there, so definitely lucky, and that's fine.
But talking about the process, you were mentioning that you actually you went out and you recorded. Talk a little about how you and Jonathan work.
So John was like, I'm gonna go and shoot this film. And in the meantime, you're going to go and, get the sound that we'll need for later. And we agreed that, I said, well, how about I spend this year trying to make 24 hours in Auschwitz and what the sound of that would be. And he said, great, let's start with that. And so that was kind of my brief of, and John, the kind of one thing he said to me was, what I don't ever want to do is get 10 actors in a booth in a sound room and say, right, now pretend this is happening, because that's just never going to work. So, and to be honest, we did, I did actually try that kind of stuff, but the sound that you hear is pretty much all sound re-recorded in real life, and it's repurposed. For example, we went to various different football matches around Europe where different nationality young men would be playing. And if you go to a football match where it's low division and there are no spectators, you will invariably hear someone screaming in pain. And that is real. And finding places like where things like that happen, hospitals are good places for pain, things like that. And the Paris riots we visited, and we listened to the torture in Belarus that happened a few years ago and things. So just, having enough time to spend combing the real world for things that actually have authenticity, because it was extraordinary. The minute we put in anything that was not credible, it would so stick out like a sore thumb, really? And it would become so obviously wrong and inappropriate. And that's a real testament to kind of how credible I think the film is, and without any sort of wooden acting or whatever is the wrong word, but yeah, it doesn't feel like in any way like a dramatization, does it?
Oh, it doesn't. And in terms of the filming, I understand that you rigged the house with cameras, that there was no crew in there, that the family was basically, as Jonathan has described it, the Nazi Big Brother house. How did that work for you?
I mean, it was really powerful because a take might be an hour long because that was the length of a memory stick in one of the 10 cameras. And the cameras would be hidden, and there were 20 hidden microphones. John's brief was, I want to hear people in the house, and we felt that observational thing of footsteps and teacups rattling and doors and everything was way more important. So we hid microphones everywhere to capture the kind of ambience of people. And that became super powerful because when we put the film together, we would have, I would have all the different microphones lined up, and I could say, okay, we still want to hear the boy banging the drum upstairs, and that needs to go over these three shots or the whole scene or whatever. And so when Rudolph is lying in the office listening to the football on the radio, and we, what really the mother, the wife was talking in the kitchen at that time, and the dog was running around, and Elfrieda was walking around with the baby, and that was crying, and the boys are upstairs, and all these things, and the the younger boy and the girl were outside the window. And so we had all those sounds that really were taking place. And, you know, and we perhaps repositioned them slightly, you know, so that you could hear everything in its own space. But very much, I think that's why the film is so powerful, because on a subliminal level, it's shockingly credible. You know, you're whereas normally a film would be, you know, you hear kind of room tone and a bit of dialogue. With John, he's creating a whole world. And that's what we're aiming to do, was to use all this, you know, really amazingly rich sound that is, you know, the film set, not only were there no crew, but it was a proper build. So the floor wasn't a sort of, let's make this floor look concrete, but actually be made of rubber so that we don't interfere with the recording of the dialogue as you would. Everything sounded like it should, and the walls were solid. And so what we had was really great sound. Yeah.
You're creating a world, you're creating something natural and really bringing us into the atrocity of the fact that it's so normal. It's atrocities committed by Mr. and Mrs. Smith, us, Commander Huss and his wife. I mean, they're hearing, but they're not listening. What did you learn about them, about this type of atrocity, from immersing yourself so much in it?
Yeah. Well, you can shut your eyes, but you can't shut your ears, I suppose, is what we're thinking. Yeah, I mean, obviously it was willful, wasn't it, that they would be like that. But I think the minute that penny drops on you, you start thinking, well, obviously that could be me. So, you know, how culpable am I in all of this? I think that was very much the point, was that, you know, this is humans doing this to other humans. And it's not, look at those Nazis. It's we all have this capacity for violence in us. And that's what we should be discussing, how we turn that down more than anything else.
Was there a scene that was more challenging than others for you?
Certainly when Rudolph is smoking a cigar in the garden and he's hearing the gas chamber at work over the wall, that was, even playing it was horrible. But, you know, getting to a point where you can use adjectives like, yeah, that's good, you know, we like that, or let's move on, you know, that, you know, there certainly was an amount of, you know, pragmatically we have to focus on working on the film, and, you know, and I know John very well and we're good friends, and so working with him is, you know, it's cathartic, because you have an end goal and you're making it, but there were periods during that process where you think, what are we doing here? You know, this is really difficult.
Well, you've really made a film that speaks not only to the past, but of course to the present. So thank you for that. I'm going to move on to some other projects you have done.
Oh, thank goodness.
But I know, I feel like. But then before I get into that, I'm wondering, when you're not on the job as a civilian, when you're walking around, maybe you're in LA now, when you're listening to things, what's your relationship to sound as a civilian? Are you working or?
Yeah, I am, unfortunately. I'm constantly thinking, oh, I wish I had a microphone, and often record stuff. And it, I think it's really interesting, because most people come at making a film soundscape by deciding what they can put in. They tend to want to start with just the dialogue, and then it's what do you add. And I always think, you know, let's go and see where that something as close to that exists in the real world, and see and put all of that in, and then see what you want to take out, kind of thing. So
interesting.
And because invariably, you know, there's cars and obviously sirens, and siren is something, if you were doing a street scene in any city, you would think to put in, but you wouldn't think to put in man with shovel digging and that weird scraping noise or any of those other. So I'm always struck by the fortuitous, spurious, strange sounds. And those are the things that I think give you a better immersion, because you're like, oh, you know, on a subconscious level, you're like, yeah, that does happen. You know, that's, yeah.
There's certain sounds you hate.
Oh God, well, the one sound I have a phobia of,
yeah,
is, you know, like paper, if it rips like that, no problem, but if paper shears and separates,
yes,
that, whatever that is, oh man, it's like I'm done for the day then on sound.
So you've never used that in a film?
I don't want to hear it.
No. That's your next horror film.
Yeah.
And what about the sound you most loved?
Oh, it's been my family. I would have thought, yeah.
People talking.
People talking. A nice, warm environment, yeah.
Anne Marie Kelly. Wild Precious Life is a podcast about dreaming big, digging in and connecting across distance, division, and loss. In each episode, I talk with prize-winning writers, musicians, and wanderers who remind all of us how we can make the most of the time we have. So meet me here. Let's walk and talk and dream and discover what it means to be wild, precious, and brave.
Let's talk about Yorgos Lanthimos, who's also a longtime collaborator. How is he different from Jonathan in terms of your collaboration with him?
Yeah, very different. Jonathan is rather hands-on and wants to understand the nuts and bolts of how we do things together. And Yorgos is exactly as meticulous and incredibly high standards. But what he says to me is, you're the sound designer, you do it. So I now get to the point of pretty much finishing a film soundscape and mix and everything before playing it to him, because it was, he's prolific, so he needs to do that. But I was talking to him last night, actually, at the Governor Awards, and about, when can I pay you the next film that we're working on, Kinds of Kindness? And he was like, have you finished it yet? And I'm like, nearly. And he said, well, that's when you play it. There's no point involving me unless you're happy. And this came about because we had done The Lobster together, and that obviously went very well. And then we were working on Killing of a Sacred Deer, and we had just got to the point of finishing editing the picture, and I'd been somewhat involved in providing sounds that worked, made the cut work, sound design pieces. And then we were about to go through, and I was about to, get him in for a spotting session and all of that stuff. And then The Favourite became unexpectedly greenlit because I think Emma Stone became free. And he came in the next day and said, listen, I'm sorry, I've got to go, and you're going to have to finish this film on your own. What? and I said, well, can we just watch it and talk through? And he was like, no, I really am going now, this minute. And
so
we didn't even have the watch the film together conversation. And the first time during the process of making it, I did the final mix, and I got a car for him to come and watch it. And, and he just said, I don't have the headspace to I'm in the middle of another film. And so we smash cut to the Cannes premiere, where I'm sitting six seats over from Yorgos, rather hot and sweaty myself, and thinking, oh my God, I hope he likes it. And, the light go dim and off, and the film plays. And then in the bar afterwards, I was like, so what did you think?
Oh my gosh.
Did you like it? Jesus. I mean, it was the worst 2 hours of my life. And,
But he loved it, right?
He loved it, yeah. I mean, well, Yorgos is Yorgos. So I said, did you like it? And he said, no, not really. And he said, but it's okay, we can fix it. And then when we fixed it, there was three things that he didn't like. So, I've earned his trust, I think, on that one. But what was interesting about that was that he really forced me to, I spent a whole lifetime giving a director three versions, do you want chicken or beef or fish or whatever? But I came to realize that there is only one solution, and you just have to think harder, and you have to wear the hat of the filmmaker, not the sound designer, and you have to find what's best for the film, and there is only one thing.
I love that advice for life.
Yeah.
There's only one way. But what was the brief he gave you for Poor Things, which sort of atmospherically feels so different from what we were just talking about? And I'm thinking that the sounds are sort of from Bella's perspective, who's learning life from the beginning.
Yeah. Honestly, he didn't give me a brief. I mean,
just do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, that I definitely always try and, work from a subjective point of view on any scene. And I remember when I first met Jordan Peele, he was like, I think I understand what you try and do with sound, and he said, it's about subjectivity, right? And even if a scene is not a POV or anything like that. I think, Yorgos knows that I understand his filmmaking. And when Yorgos chooses a collaborator, it is exactly, you are chosen because you understand how I want to make a film, and you understand what we're all trying to do here. So do your thing. And here's the space in which you have as much free space as you like to do what you want to do. So yeah, that was all about, on the one hand, creating unusual environments that stood up and sounded normal in amongst, these extraordinary set builds and how kind of wild and surreal they are, so that people like my mother, who would say, "What do you mean you do the sound on films? They sound all right to me." They would think that that sounded normal when it isn't, but, you know, but commensurately feels like it. And then understanding how to, yeah, exactly as you say, how to pitch every scene so that it becomes a protagonist's point of view, normally better.
And what is the sound that you use to make God's belch?
Yeah, well, I won't do it right now, but there's, yeah, it is a belch. And it's also, I mean, so much of sound I tend to do with my own voice. The process of making note was a lot of the sound design the first 6 months was Jordan and I on a Zoom call.
Jordan Peele's Nope, you're talking about, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, Jordan Peele's Nope. But there was, for 6 months, I would meet him two or three times a week for an hour on Zoom, where I would go through what I had discovered. And a lot of it, because it was a Zoom call, I would just do with my mouth, because that was the easiest way of demonstrating to him. And so those things stayed in the film. But yeah, so that's what God's
thing.
Oh,
you have
is.
To demonstrate something now that you said it from Nope. Well,
on Nope, there's the of the monster is a, and the is the, it's searching, but it's like that's massively slowed down. So
amazing.
So that's the kind of big monster sound. But and so God's thing was a combination of a burp and this thing that these amazing Foley team did with a tube, a pipe, and a flask and a big funnel thing. So
yeah, talking about Jordan Peele, because the sound is absolutely stunning in Nope. It's like the same idea, right? Lots of the violence isn't really shown. We're feeling the violence through your work. What was his brief in terms of how he wanted that to feel?
Yeah, he's he's very hands-on, Jordan. He really understands sound. You know, he's a musician and all of those multiply talented people things. But he what was the brief? It was, and that was really interesting, because he sent me the script and I sent him back a few ideas that I thought would help use sound slightly more integratedly, and he sent me and he'd put them all in. You know, he would embrace the idea of revising the script a little in order to push the sound narrative. And I think that's really powerful, because there's so much where you obviously don't have to see something, because the image that you draw in your own head is always going to be more scary than the one that you get shown. So I think that's what he was sort of really understanding. And what were his briefs? So much of it was just about creating an identity and a character for this monster, something that was sort of unique and iconic, I think, was the main gist.
Is there a genre or a filmmaker that you'd love to work in or with that really would be a challenge for you? I mean, you've done so much.
I would have liked to work with Cassavetes, and I would have. I mean, I do want to work with Safdie brothers. Either one of them would do.
Interesting.
But,
why?
But just because I think that Good Time is so extraordinary, and the energy in Uncut Gems, and just because I think they are, you know, really forward thinking and trying to break boundaries, and that's what I find really exciting is trying to tell stories in new ways of telling stories.
Cassavetes is an interesting, I mean, because that's, you know, very naturalistic and people talking and what other films and sound designers have influenced you historically? I'm thinking you're going to say Walter Murch.
Walter Murch would be easily the go-to, wouldn't it? I mean, extraordinary. Obviously Apocalypse Now is an incredible seminal film for which the term sound design was coined, pretty much. And Blowout, that Brian De Palma film, that is an amazing use of sound, and very useful for someone like me to explain to someone who is outside the industry, you know, this is what a sound designer person does.
Of course, right.
The topic of the narrative, the plot or whatever. But I'm absolutely excited by any filmmaker who wants to who understands that, you know, just because sound is cheap, it doesn't mean that it's not a very powerful, you know, 50% of the experience kind of thing.
And what filmmakers now, as a cinema goer, are, do you sit in the audience and think, is the Safdie brothers you mentioned, are there more?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, who's using sound? Ryan Coogler is using sound pretty well. I think Sofia Coppola thinks about sound well. I think there's got to be more than that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
This is terrible. Trey Schultz, Trey Edward Schultz, you know, Waves and Creature.
I only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, because you've worked with these amazing artists, I understand, like Travis Scott and Madonna, even Prince, David Bowie. What is something you learned from someone like David Bowie that you've carried on?
With him, probably be nice to people, be pleasant. And, you know,
I love that, because he was, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely charming. And even, you know, to a sort of, yeah, I mean, to everybody, you know, to everybody you meet, even the person who brings you the cup of tea, have a conversation with them and enrich their lives.
And in terms of sound?
Oh, right. Well, I mean, goodness, Madonna scared the hell out of me. I spent 2 weeks sitting with her, and normally, you know, someone would sit in the room with you, but Madonna sits at the mixing desk with you, you know, next to you, you know, in your space, and is sort of like, how about 368 kilohertz? And you're like, what? Oh my God, you know so much. I'm, you know,
good for her.
Professionally threatened. So, yeah, I think what I learned from those early experiences was that in order to have the creative space to do something really well, you need to have the technical aspects locked down so tightly that they are second nature. So, so all of the, I had some traumatizing experiences where I realized I needed to now go and stay up very late for a number of weeks and learn some stuff that I didn't know.
Well, that's how it's done. You need your 10,000 hours or whatever it's called.
Yeah, well, maybe more.
Maybe more. Mr. Byrne, thank you so much for taking your time with me, and thank you for, you really made incredible cinematic experiences for me this year, and I really appreciate it. I'll carry them with me.
Christina, it's so lovely to talk to you, and thank you for your kind words. Yeah, really lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much to Johnny Byrne, sound designer, supervising sound editor, and re-recording mixer on The Zone of Interest, Poor Things, and so many other films. And thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on X and Instagram at Christina Biro, B-I-R-R-O. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. See you next time.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.